Welcome to the Healing of Agape this week. This week we have with us Dr. Roy Scruggs, and today we're just actually going to do a dialogue on the topic of consciousness, like the dialogues Roy and I do when we sit around on the back porch all the time. So this will share with you one of those conversations. So morning, Roy.
Good morning. How you doing?
So you were just telling me that you do your best observing a thought in the morning. What were you observing?
As a matter of fact, early this morning, I was sitting and reflecting on the discussion that we've had many times, reassuring ourselves that some of the old symbols that we have, the yin-yang symbol, for example, in particular that symbolism has survived for thousands of years, and it must have meaning, and we sometimes wonder whether we really agree that it has meaning or not, because in the yin-yang, as you know, it's the dance of opposites. And one of the things that occurs to me is that, let's say that we have a couple who consider themselves to be mates or even soulmates. They are clearly distinct from each other, but it's very difficult for anybody to conclude that they're opposite of each other. I mean, physically, there are obvious attributes of the physical person that say, yeah, you know, there's an anti-symmetry, but is that really true all the way through? I mean, isn't there anything we agree on? Obviously you do agree on a great deal, but you disagree on some things. And so that's what causes the distinction. And I mean it in this way. If you take two humans, or you can do this in the world of physics or theology or anywhere you want to, you can do this. If you take two entities and you ask, these two entities are different. And mathematically speaking, we call that asymmetry. That is, they're not the same.
Let's not use the word entities. I think that might confuse people. Let's use the word a particle or mass.
We can do it with physical particles, and we can do it with human beings as well.
Yeah, okay, let's use one of those so they understand we're not talking about a ghost or something.
Right, okay, well, but I want to use the human, because this gets very subtle and it gets subjective, and yet it has abstract value at the same time. If I say you have a couple, as we were talking about, and the point is that they're alike in some ways and different in some ways, and we call that asymmetry. That is, they're not the same. But now it turns out that if you look at this carefully, you can reduce that asymmetry to two things taken together, symmetry and anti-symmetry. So there is much about the two that is the same. It's like agreeing on something, right? Mm. And your value judgments are the same with respect to a lot of things. It's either going to be that, or it's going to be diametrically opposed. Right? And that part that's diametrically opposed is called the mirror image or the anti-symmetry. So if you take two entities and you compare one entity to the other, whether it's a human being or a particle, when you do that, you basically have an array of things that you can evaluate, whether it's for atoms or particles or molecules or human beings. You have an array of things that you can compare with each other. And when you're able to separate, when you take two such particles or two such beings, and you say, how are they different? Well, they're clearly different. Right? But exactly how are they different? They're not different in most ways, and that's called the symmetry. There are particular ways when they're not only different, they're opposite. And that's the only difference between them.
I have a question here. I don't know why I'm thinking about this.
Now, this is a mathematical concept, but it turns out that it holds a lot of water. When you start to really look at it, it turns out to be quite orderly, quite a good expression.
Let's say, how would the opposite of this be? If you have a molecule, say, let's just pick hydrogen, proton, neutron, and electron. How would the next hydrogen molecule be different?
The hydrogen molecule, of course, as we know, the hydrogen molecule is the hydrogen atom is the simplest of all the atoms, right? And of course, it has a proton in its nucleus, which weighs 1,835 times heavier than an electron, but they have the same charge. In other words, the force of attraction between them is equal.
Right.
So the only way you keep them separate from each other is by having the electron circle rapidly around the proton, and that's the conceptual model that we use. It says, okay, in other words, the yin-yang dance, right, is completely compatible with that. Right?
Well, my question is, if no two things are alike, if we all agree that there aren't any two things alike, how would, say there's two hydrogen molecules, how would one differ from the other?
Just in a state of motion.
Okay.
That's the only thing that distinguishes them.
Okay.
Because their attributes are the same otherwise.
Okay.
So we're talking about a class of things that we call a thing, and what we're talking about is a class of things, and we characterize the class. But they're certainly just their motion makes them different. But that's also true of people too, as far as that goes. But the whole idea of sameness and differentness has always been. A lot of people have had a hard time with the yin yang because you say, well, now. You say this is the dance of opposites. I don't really think that it's entirely true that I'm the opposite of my mate. I mean, I'm opposite in some obvious ways, but I'm really not, because I have compassion and caring and sharing and agreeing with my mate. So what do you mean when you say yin-yang dance? And what happens is that gets resolved into the symmetric part and the anti-symmetric part, and the anti-symmetric part, the mirror image part, is there. It is there, and it's real. Now, the interesting part about this is that the symmetric, we talked about just a moment ago the fact that in a hydrogen atom that you have the simplest and purest form of the dance of opposites, in the sense that they're of the opposite, exactly opposite charge, and they're held apart by the yin-yang dance, which is we say that's kind of the simplest model we can come forward with. What about the symmetric part? Well, in the case of the hydrogen atom, there doesn't seem to be a symmetric part. Now, there might be, but if so, it's below the level of atomic structure, quark level. But let's again return to people and ask what happens to that part of us that is in full agreement. Well, if we're in full agreement, there's no way to distinguish one of us from another. So the only way that a human being can be in full agreement...
You know, that's right. A lot of times people say that couple, whoever they are,
right,
are so similar, you can't tell one from the other.
Yeah, right. And you might as well be looking at a single entity.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, oftentimes, socially, we will conclude that. And we see couples that are, you know, getting along fine together, and we tend to think of them as one thing, one entity. So if I approach John and Jill with an issue, and I understand John and Jill to be united, I don't think about a decision from either one of them. I think about a decision
from you get the same decision.
Exactly. So that's the symmetric part. And to that extent, you can't distinguish them. You can't distinguish them. But you will discover the differences, and that's the anti-symmetric part. And the interesting part about it is that it's not asymmetry. It's not just difference. It's opposite.
Mm-hmm.
When one is going to answer yes to, on something, the other one will very definitely answer no. It won't be maybe.
You know, and one of the topics that's yes and no on a lot in the world is psychic phenomena.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's a big one. You know, people, they're either for it or they're against it. Mm-hmm. If they're against it, it's crazy and it doesn't happen and you're lying.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sitting here looking at Bill Tiller's book, Science and Human Transformation, Subtle Energies, Intentionality, and Consciousness. That's his first one he said, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, however, after symmetry breaking, only some topological charges are conserved. Electric charges conserve, but magnetic charges not.
Mm-hmm.
So we can conclude from this, when one wishes consider the phenomenon wherein magnetic charge is important, one must focus on the higher level of reality than that of the purely physical reality. You know, and that would explain, if you're not open to that next level that's held together or occurs due to magnetism,
mm-hmm.
you're missing out on something.
Yeah, well, here's the interesting thing about this. One of the interesting things about modern science, physics in particular, of course, is that there is this huge effort to symmetrize the world. That is, to be able to show that the world is symmetric. You know, that for everything there is a careful balance of something else. Now, that's the symmetric part that we were talking about, whether we're talking about atoms or whether we're talking about personalities. The way in which things are the same leaves no room for distinction. And so the only way that distinction can come about is through anti-symmetry. It's not asymmetry because there's a symmetric part that collapses. It collapses. The anti-symmetric part.
For people like me, I only understand this because I've been talking to you forever, but a lot of people won't understand what you mean it collapses.
Well, it collapses because there's no distinction. In other words, we talked about a couple earlier, and we said we don't see the couple as a couple. We see the couple as an entity because they've collapsed mm-hmm. into oneness. Right? So when we ask a question of the two of them, we're asking a question to one.
I guess right? A good way to describe that would be if you hold all five fingers up, fingertips, and put the fingertips together,
mm-hmm.
you can push your hands together and collapse.
That's right.
But if you put your fingertips amongst one another,
yeah.
you can't. So you don't have the collapsion.
Or if you have six fingers on one hand and three on another, or four on another, or five on another, you can't do a one-to-one match. So there will always
right.
be an asymmetry there. When you attempt to match up the hands, there will be an asymmetry. And that asymmetry is the thing that causes
distinction. There's still something left.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, in the case of magnetism, that was very interesting because we've never been able, for example, with electric charge, we find that either happening as a positive unit charge or a negative unit charge. But they're always both present. Always. Everywhere in the universe that we know of.
It has to be, or they'd be...
Yeah, and there's a principle in physics called conservation of charge. It says for every positive unit of charge, there is a negative unit. So that if you added them all up, you get zero. Right? So, that's called the symmetry, the symmetric part of the universe. Now, in the case of magnetism, very interesting because we've never been able to find a magnetic monopole, that is, a unit of magnetism that's positive and a unit of magnetism that's negative.
Well, how are they then?
Well, that's one of the
they're
great...
They're one or the other?
Well, that's one of the great conundrums being dealt with today, you know, not very well, unfortunately. There's been this relentless search for the magnetic monopole and can't find it. You know? And the reason is, I think, my own personal opinion is, that magnetism is so fundamentally different from charge. Like if we have protons and electrons, we can, you know, kind of understand each one of those has equal and opposite charge. We can't find
anything
like that.
Is it a field or a wave or what is it?
Well, the thing about the, let me back a minute. When we look at electric charge, it doesn't care anything about direction. It acts the same in every direction. So whether I have an electron sitting here with a field, an electric field associated with it, or a proton, either one, those two don't care about direction. It's the same pull or the same.
I understand.
Right. But now with a magnet, definitely not true, and we all know that, and we've done high school experiments where we know that that's the truth. The magnet very definitely is direction dependent, right? So depending on how you orient the magnet, you have
that push or pull.
Push or pull. So if you flip it by 180 degrees, suddenly push turns into pull. Or if you rotate it, you will find that it will have different effects at different places in space. If you rotate an electron, whatever that would mean, or rotate a proton, who knows what that means. But if you did that, you wouldn't find any difference anywhere. So it's something that's called gauge invariance. I don't want to get into a lot of physical abstraction here, but the point is that there's something fundamentally different between magnets and electric particles. Now, the interesting thing about a hydrogen atom is that it doesn't, it has a proton at the middle, right, and it has an electron, and they have this neat little dance going on. There is no evidence of a magnet being there, right? In other words, we got one pole of electric charge and the opposite pole of electric charge, and they do their little dance. There is no presence of a magnet. Right? There just isn't, right? So it doesn't show up. Now, that doesn't mean that magnetic effects aren't there. They are, but we won't get into that. There are a lot of issues that we have in physics today that call questions up about the validity of our view of the physical world, and they're serious. There's serious problems there. We have missed something. I've maintained this for some time, and there are a few others who've observed the same thing, not just me.
William Tiller being one.
Tiller, Tom Bearden, Myron Evans. I mean, the list goes on. There are a lot. And David Bohm knew that something was wrong, right? And so did the great Richard Feynman. Feynman also did that. They know something's wrong, but we don't quite know how to fix it, right? But it's probably the next. As far as our growth of consciousness about the nature of the physical world, that's probably the next level of evolution.
Now, I understand what you mean when you say there's something wrong, because we've had this conversation so many times, but for the average person listening, what is the something wrong?
The something wrong is that it appears that in building the physical theories that we now have, something was missed. Well, now, usually we don't talk about searching for things. We talk about research. We say, we're doing research in physics. Well, literally, research means to go back and look again, because the implicit assumption is that if you've done everything correctly and completely up to now, and the only incompleteness is
what
not
you don't know.
Right, and that you, and it assumes that everything you've discovered up to that point has been consistent and complete to that point is still incomplete. In that case, you're searching. But if it's incomplete, or let's put it this way, you get to a point and you have this conundrum that says, something's wrong. And we're doing everything we can to move forward with this, and it won't move. We can't move it. What that means is that you need to go back and look again because you missed something. It's like, how did you get up the stepladder if there was a rung missing? Right? So you have to go back and see what you left out.
What'd they leave out?
What was left out was that amazingly enough, after James Clerk Maxwell developed the initial theory of electromagnetism, and he did a beautiful job, he wrote it all down completely. But it's a long story, and we won't get into it. But basically what happened was some other people came along after him and said, this is very difficult. They didn't have computers at the time. And I said, we can't really get anywhere with this. It's too complicated. So they simplified it. And in simplifying the original theory that he developed, which was consistent with the physical evidence, of many people, in particular Faraday. So he had a theory, and so they simplified it. And when they did that, some things were dropped out of consideration. That were by doing the simplification, something was lost. Now, back around 1904.
Are we talking about their computing of numbers to?
Well,
to,
it's not so much
symbolize.
It's not so much the computing, as the completeness of the mathematical model, and the mathematical model that came out of this after the simplification had holes in it. I mean, it looked beautiful, right? And nobody questions that. Beautiful theory. But it's incomplete, has holes in it. So it doesn't explain in the way that it should.
Oh, I see.
Now, what happened was around 1903 and 04, one of my favorite, all-time favorite mathematicians and philosophers, physicists, whatever you want to call him, a guy named E.T. Whitaker, he wrote a paper in the London Royal Society. He was in the London Royal Society. He wrote a paper. He said, by the way, I want to point out that here's the general solution to the original equation set forth by James Clerk Maxwell. And a lot of people looked at it and said, but you know perfectly well that we don't need this part here. You've presented something here that's more than we need. And they said, besides that, we consider it to be an artifact. Now, this artifact thing is very important because typically what will happen, particularly in physics, is when you build a mathematical model of physical reality, you really are impressed by its explanatory power and the fact that it's extensible. That is, you can take that model and model a whole lot of different phenomena. And that gives you confidence in the theory. See, it says it works on this kind of thing, works on that kind of thing. Wow, it must be true. And we tend to forget after a while that the map is not the territory. Right? And so the map, the theory, is assumed to be in one-to-one correspondence to reality, and it isn't. And not only that, but what happens is that when you get the mathematical solution...
In other words, it's like a map where... You're pulled way back from a far distance, so you only get the main thing.
Look, a map will help you to navigate the territory, but it's not the territory.
Right.
You might have a difficult time walking the territory if you didn't have the map.
Right.
But the map is not the territory, it's a guide.
It doesn't show every hill there that you got to
Exactly. It does not reveal the experience. It's simply a guide. And that's what a theory is. A theory is simply a guide to help you know where you are, right, when you're doing something. So what E.T. Whitaker pointed out is, look, here's the solution. And the other guy said, well, yeah, but we don't need that part. We consider that to be an artifact. Now, guys came along later, like Feynman and others, and said, well, wait a minute. Why? It seems even though you claim you don't need this other part of the theory, why are you ignoring it?
It's there for some reason.
It's there for some reason. Exactly right. And in wave mechanics... these are called these solutions. There, and I don't want to get into this too much, but in the wave equation, there are two solutions that come out of that. And what you do is you say, well, I need this one, but I don't need the other one because I can explain what's happening here by using just one of these solutions. Therefore, the other solution is meaningless. It's called an artifact, mathematical artifact. It's simply quaint, sitting there, not needed. But if you believe in your mathematical model, you can't walk away from it like that. And
but
finally,
there's something
finally said
different.
That, right?
You got to figure out what that difference
it
is.
It just means that we haven't heard the whole story. It's prudent to assume that we haven't thought about enough yet. And Feynman pointed that out, and he actually has he won a Nobel Prize because of that very explanatory power. But to go back to what Whitaker did, most of what he revealed in his calculation was something that nobody thought represented reality. Now it turns out that it does. One of the reasons that we have so much trouble with quantum theory, again, another map, right? It's a map, not the territory. There's nothing wrong with quantum mechanics. There's definitely something wrong with quantum theory, right, which is the map.
So what's the difference?
Well, the problem with quantum theory is that we have something called duality. And duality says that, when we run an experiment, there's going to be, for this experiment, you're going to need to interpret things as being wave-like. But when I do another experiment, I'm going to need to interpret things as being particle-like. So wait a minute now. We're using one theory here, and we're having to choose between one interpretation and another, and that's not what we think theories ought to do.
Really, what it should be about is putting the two together.
But what happens in quantum theory is it comes out they're distinct. And so this duality has been a matter of huge debate for 100 years as to why is this true? Why? Well, because in quantum mechanics, when experiments are done, some of the experimental results seem to show wave-like behavior in you interpret the experimental result as being wave-like. And in another experiment, you think you're almost forced to interpret the data as implying a particle. Mm-hmm. And so whenever the theory was formed, I said, okay, we'll take that into account. So part of the theory says it's particle-like, and part of the theory says it's wave-like. And when you put those two together, you come up with a theory, an equation that can be solved to tell you what's going on in a particular case. But the fact of the matter is that equation, at one and the same time, includes this uncertainty about whether or not something is a particle.
Well, that doesn't make any sense.
It actually doesn't. No, and the position taken in natural philosophy, the position taken is that, well, look, this is a phenomenal result. Here are the phenomena.
Because if you put those particles and the waves together, then it makes a one united, so there's really no duality.
But why would you, right, that's what it should be. Now, here, to come back to what Whitaker did, the part that got ignored was the part where he said there is a longitudinal wave. And this gets into technical detail. Let me go over it very quickly. An electromagnetic wave is called a transverse wave. It's like, the wave moves forward, but it goes laterally, right? And so that's the transverse nature of the wave. The impact of the wave in the longitudinal direction is zero. It only has transverse momentum. In other words, it can exhibit force laterally but not longitudinally. Now, of course, if a particle were moving alongside a wave, it very definitely would have momentum in the direction of motion. So if your car runs into a wall, you're going to know it, right? If a wave runs into a wall, it doesn't know it. It just reflects or it penetrates, whichever. So they're kind of like they're really distinct, right? Well, what he pointed out was there's a longitudinal wave involved and implied by these phenomenal results that were obtained by Faraday and others and kept by James Clerk Maxwell. He kept it. It was in there. And when Whitaker said there's a longitudinal wave, everybody noticed, well, we don't see it. No, not there. Guess what? The longitudinal wave is the one that causes the apparent particle-like behavior in the experiments. It provides the longitudinal momentum. That's what's been missing. And so that's what we're driving at right now with the theoretical unfolding that's happening, and the mathematical work that's going on to rebuild that and to come up with a new theory that's more complete. Yeah, and that's the completeness that we've been missing.
Because if you have like a beam of sunlight, it's going straight or vertical.
Yeah.
But it's also emitting energy from the sides that go out horizontally.
Yeah, that's right. But now, the question of the reaction forces due to let's say we have
a lightsaber thing.
Well, yeah, let's say we have a radio tower. Right, and the radio tower has a cylindrical broadcasting thing up on the top, and it broadcasts the wave out, and our radios pick it up. Now, if you go away from that radio tower and you build yourself an antenna, let's say a large antenna, and those waves hit that antenna and are absorbed by it, or detected by it, and dealt with, if the longitudinal effect is there, we would expect that antenna, that receiving antenna, to feel a force. And it does. It's very small. Very, very small. And people have, put forth various explanations for why that is. None of which explanations include longitudinal momentum. Okay. So what we're saying is that whatever this longitudinal effect is, it's small, but exceedingly important. Very important, because it's causing us all kinds of confusion and the use of incomplete theories. But most people will say, well, look, you know, why are you worried about quantum theory being incomplete, considering that it's been one of the most successful, if not the most successful, physical theory ever?
Well, look, right? I have a question.
Which it has. I don't argue with that. It has.
And I might not know what I'm talking about here, but I'm sure if I do, you'll understand.
Mm-hmm.
If there wasn't any wave that went this way, why would we have it? How would we have like a grid?
Well, it's the reason. Let me give you an example of why we know that sunlight or the waves coming from this lamp bulb here, how we know that they go like laterally. Polaroid glasses. So when you wear Polaroid glasses, they have little, very tiny lines, and they're horizontal lines, very closely spaced. And what happens is it's kind of like a Venetian blind, in that it limits the amount of light that comes through. Does let the light through, but it limits it, and it does that by selecting just those transverse components that can slide through the slits, and that's the way it limits the amount of light coming through without distorting it, without hurting it, just cuts down its magnitude. So that's one of the experimental ways that we know that light waves are transverse, and there are many other ways of determining that. But the point is that it's like this. If you had a sufficiently good detector, you not only would you be seeing the reduced light coming through, you would also feel a little bit of force on the glasses that you had on your sitting on your nose. Mm-hmm. And that little bit of force that you would feel is due to the longitudinal component, because it hits the glasses and bounces back. And so that's that longitudinal component that's very small, but yet very important, because the incompleteness of quantum theory, in my opinion, is largely that. It's largely about having missed that part. And it leads us to conclusions that are not really rational. That something cannot be both a particle and a wave. The way people think about it now, and I suspect they're thinking the right thing for the wrong reasons, but the argument now is that when you observe an experiment, is something called collapsing the wave vector, you know, the state vector, rather, that involves either wave or particle behavior. And whenever you perform the experiment and when consciousness enters into play, the act of observing reduces it to one or the other. And I say, well, okay, I mean, fine. You know, but why would consciousness choose one over the other? Why would it choose a wave and not a particle? Well, never mind that. That's what it does. Well, I'm sorry. You know, I have no problem at all about the participation of consciousness in the unfolding of experimental observations. No, I mean, that's essentially part. It is essential. It's part of it. But not in the way in which the argument is used now. It's just unsatisfactory. It's not parsimonious. And by parsimonious, we mean it's not the simplest explanation that there could be for the phenomenon observed. And if science in general has any unspoken and implicit principle, it is parsimony. And that's the way we choose one theory over another, otherwise known as Occam's razor. Right? It says, look, if I've got something here that I need to explain, Joe over here offers this explanation, and John offers this explanation, and I choose the simpler one to explain the phenomenon. As long as they both explain the phenomena equally,
in full.
In full, then you will take the simpler one over the more complicated one, and that's called parsimony. And that's implicit in all physical philosophy and thinking. And so, therefore, you know, when you're faced with quantum theory the way it is now, you have this deep feeling that, you know, we're not getting the simplest explanation we can get here. Right?
So, the thing that began this conversation was a lot of people dispute psychic phenomena. So whether we like it or not, what you just said describes it in physics. That's the facts. Now, the people out there that don't understand physics, what did you just say? What did you just verify?
Well, the fact that we are sometimes stupefied or overwhelmed by paranormal phenomena is to me not any different than me being overwhelmed by not understanding what happens in quantum theory either. I find quantum theory to be repugnant. Now, there are other people who say, well, quantum theory is beautiful, right? Everybody agrees on it. And it has explanatory power. You don't have any theory that explains paranormal phenomena. And because there is none, we reject it out of hand. Well, I actually tend to reject quantum theory more than I do paranormal phenomena, because paranormal phenomena are just as real as the experiments performed in quantum mechanics. And I don't see any distinction, really, from the experimental point of view. I don't see any distinction between them. If I run an experiment with particles and I claim to have a theory that explains what goes on, and that theory is unsatisfactory, as far as I'm concerned, I might as well not have a theory. Right. And so, and in paranormal phenomena, we don't have a theory. And so, therefore, it gets rejected because there is no theory, which is wrong. That's not right.
The other day, I was at the law office where I work, and there was a secretary there that doesn't believe in psychic phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawyer there was telling her about what I do, you know, the medical intuition stuff that I do.
Right.
And she just looked at me and dead straight said, that's not real.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I said, you know what, I don't care whether you believe it or not, it happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've got hundreds and hundreds of people that has watched it happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if I can tell you what's wrong with you, how can you deny to me that that happens?
Mm-hmm.
How would I know what's wrong with you?
Mm-hmm.
It comes from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And people, I don't care who they are, they can't keep denying that it exists. And I mean, let me do it for you and then tell me that it's not real.
Well, I think with people like this is it somehow represents a threat to their understanding of the world. And if you have a limited understanding of the world, and that's all you have is a certain limited understanding, and you're comfortable with that, any introduction of new information looks like magic. And a lot of people don't like magic because they generally tend to think of it as being black magic.
Well, don't they understand that that's magic. How the information of all there is came over time?
Yeah, it's revelatory. It comes from the mind. You know, there's no evidence at all that the mind thinks about anything. It knows but doesn't think. We do our thinking with our brain. And exclusively, that's what the brain does. It thinks. And it doesn't sometimes think very well because it's not receiving the knowing from the brain most of the time. It'll get a little bit here and there.
Most of the time, it's perceiving. Conditioning.
There's
conditioned perception.
This revelation that we get from time to time that we call creativity is a sudden, opportunity that the mind has to project knowing into the brain, and the brain then starts to process it, and we call that thinking.
Well, for people that don't understand, I mean, we have a meeting of the minds on what we mean when we say creativity. We mean more than just sit down and draw a picture.
Yes.
Where did it come from?
That's right.
It suddenly just dropped down in your head.
That's exactly.
Where did that come from?
Precisely.
That's something.
Here's the thing about it, and most people don't use the method that William James did. He actually would go back and reobserve carefully, because he created modern psychology, and he would get revelations. And these would always occur instantaneously.
Exactly.
And in whole cloth.
And all at one time.
All at one time in whole cloth. It's as though it were holographically projected into the brain.
It's like you see it for painters. They see a painting in their head.
Instantaneously.
Yeah, and then they go and put that painting together with strokes.
Yeah. Probably have to redo it a whole bunch of times, don't they, in order to get the translation correct. I mean, we do the same thing in physics. We do it in medicine. We do it in chemistry. We do it everywhere. When the creativity arrives, it in and of itself is whole cloth, but our interpretation of it requires a lot of effort and a lot of thinking and a lot of physical effort too, perhaps. But that doesn't answer the question, where did it come from? Because typically what we do with our ego is as soon as it arrives, we take ownership of it, as though it came from us, whatever that means. And that's the danger of ego, is in taking credit for something that you didn't bring about in the first place.
You know, I was reading, like I said, Bill Tiller's book.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read you what it says here. Dr. Tiller's description of the band broadening effect. When two people work together on a problem helps explain the benefits derived from active listening. More healing may occur in the space between the words than by the words themselves, because impulses of information and energy bombard our bodies every moment. Their effects are dependent upon our receptivity and interpretations based upon past perception beliefs. So, we can only comprehend truth to the extent to which it resonates with some portion of our already perceived reality. What he's saying here, I think, is information is carried in time, space, pulse, intervals, in the electromagnetic field somehow, like somebody using Morse code with a flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it runs through our body circuits.
Right.
And if that's true, and it is, from a physics perspective, it's true.
Yeah. I think Dean Radin would certainly, and other psychologists would certainly agree with that.
And that means that the rate at which that pulses has got to tell us something, and it can affect the frequency of our organs by sending in the wrong kind of time-space pulse intervals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And pulses.
The phasing has got a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
The phasing. But the irreducible time, of course, that's well recognized in psychology, that there is, something on the order of a tenth of a second for your body to actually perceive something or grasp it and, in some sense, integrate it.
And it would also explain why stuff suddenly drops down, that change of that surging would control or obtain knowledge within it and code, like a flashlight, doing the Morse code. Mm-hmm. That would be logical.
Certainly frequency is implied from that point of view and many other points of view as well. But frequency is, in my opinion, more fundamental than time. If I went to measure something about the universe, I would be better off to do it in frequency.
Of course, because if we have no clocks, what time is it?
Right.
Right now time.
Right. You would perceive light whether you had a clock or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, light is primarily frequency. It's characterized by frequency. So, but of course the mystics have told us that for centuries, millennia. But we continue to be hypnotized by time, and which is good and bad, as I think has been said many times. We have time, so everything won't happen at once. And if we want to be powerful beings, then we need time.
We got about 15 minutes for this segment, even though this is our regular Sunday morning discussion.
Mm.
Let's talk a minute about free will. You know how I think about free will? We don't have any, I don't think. If so, couldn't you guarantee me you're going to meet me at Starbucks tomorrow at 3 o'clock and nothing would stop it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't have any problem with will. In other words, it's my will to pick up this glass of water. Thirsty, and I won't have a drink of water, so I willfully pick up the glass and drink the water. It's an act of will. I don't have to. I could put off the thirst.
Which should also be called intent.
A very low level of intent.
There was an intent that came, so the will picked it up.
Yeah, but intention has a much more powerful and far-reaching implication.
Yes.
So I'm particularly concerned here by will. So I don't think any of us have any. Now, where the problem comes in is when we append the word free to will and create the phrase free will, the first thing I have to ask is, what is free? I think I have a sensate understanding of will in that it's an actual physical. Will typically involves a physical act. It may not, but it typically does. And so we can deal with that. Now, free is because free is a relative term. You have to ask yourself, what is not free? For free to have meaning, you have to understand not free. but free, so therefore what I'm saying is that the word free is context dependent, right? Very much so. So when I combine the two, free will, I lose track of what that means. So I don't use the term. It's used a lot in theology, but I don't use that terminology because I don't understand it. I really don't understand it. Now, intention is a much higher form of will, and there's nothing at all in the definition of intention that says anything at all about free. It just says intention is. And ultimately it comes from the one, because if you track down intention, you're going to trace it back and trace it back, and it's finally going to be something that emerges from the one.
Well, it has to. If we have no thinking mechanism, there has to be something to process it.
Yeah, intention has to arise not as a product of thought. See, will now is a product. It's a lower level kind of intention where I intend to get some water and drink it because I'm thirsty, right? Or whatever the case may be, is a more immediacy to it. So we can find the origin of that. We can find why it's being invoked, the will is being invoked. In the case of intention, it's not so clear. Not clear at all. So my own feeling about it is that intention can be hidden, and we don't know about intention, but yet it's still active, right?
Yeah, they've proven that with the tennis ball. You know, yep. I told you yesterday, Bill Tiller told me that he had some fruit fly larvae.
Mm-hmm.
And one, he placed intention that he wanted them to accelerate their growth rate right by 25%, and mm-hmm. one, he didn't do anything at all.
Right.
And the one that he placed that intention on grew
yep.
25% faster, developed to adulthood 25%
we
faster.
Were
That's
doing,
significant numbers.
Absolutely. We were doing experiments on that 35 years ago at the Lockheed Research Lab. It was not... I mean, it wasn't supported research. It was after-hours kind of research, you understand. But we actually had some seeds at the lab, and we had some seeds with some people up in North Carolina, hundreds of miles away.
You're in Atlanta, right?
We were in Atlanta, and the other seeds were up in North Carolina, a long ways off. And those people were instructed to concentrate on their seeds to grow, and we ignored ours. And we compared the growth rates of the two sets of seeds months later, and significant difference, much greater rate of growth for the ones out there. And the reference
you set just watered yours and stuff without any.
Yeah, I just ignored them, you know, and they paid attention to theirs. Other experiments have been done where people will love their plants, you know, and talk to their plants, and then you know, have one plant that they really love and pay attention to, and have another plant that they intentionally have negative attitude about it, and don't like it, and you find a difference in the growth rate.
So. I read something in a magazine not too long ago about plants. I can't remember who it was in a Reader's Digest or some kind of magazine like that, and it said that this doctor, that he didn't like traffic and being around people a lot, so he would come in his work like 5:30 in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and he had electrodes hooked up to these plants, and he thought, okay, there's nobody else around. He thought, what can I do to these plants that would be different that I can record on electrodes? He thought, oh, okay, I'll burn it with a match.
Mm-hmm.
Well, before he ever even got the match,
mm-hmm.
the electrodes went crazy.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, who was the fellow who wrote the book on that?
You know, the plants knew his thought before he even burned them.
I'm trying to remember the famous book where that whole issue was dealt with. It's amazing. So, you know, when people like the lady that you knew at the office who rejects healing and paranormal phenomena, wonder what she would think of something like that.
She would deny it.
Yeah, because, you know, there's the evidence.
It either prints out on the paper or it doesn't.
Yeah, it either prints out on the paper or it doesn't. And if it prints on the paper, it's not random. Now, that gets to another issue here concerning the whole, and the reason why I think intention, even though we may not be able to get our arms around intention, we may not be able to understand it, it's important to know that it's there. When we talk about things being random, I have trouble with that notion of being random. And the reason why is something that's random is something that we are inferring, that it occurs without cause. In other words, it has no relationship to cause and effect. And I'm saying I don't really understand.
Well,
that
if that were true, if everything was random, then we wouldn't have things that clump together. I mean, everything's atoms.
Right. Yeah.
Why would things clump? Why would atoms clump to be a tree or a body or
right.
a lamppost?
The mere fact that we can't determine the state of something.
Something told it to.
That's right. Just because we can't determine the state of something doesn't mean that it doesn't have cause for being in the state that it's in. But what we do is a matter of primarily, you know, look, the idea of something being random.
It's really organized chaos.
There is no, you can't actually distinguish between something that we call random and another. We say that one process is random and another process is chaotic. The fact of the matter is that you can't distinguish between the two. So whatever they are, they're the same. They're not different. And so because you put a different word tag on them doesn't change it, right? Just giving it a different word doesn't change anything. You know?
Right.
And so it's either going
to be... If you deny it, it doesn't change the fact that it exists.
M. Scott Peck one time made one of the biggest errors in statement I've ever heard. He said, once you name something, you know it. And I couldn't disagree with him more. But naming something is an illusion. It gets you to believe that you understand something when you don't. So words come after the knowing, not before. You don't come to know something by naming it. You know it and then name it.
Yeah, right? The name's just a symbol of what it is.
Precisely. It's a tag. It's a tag that we put on. So anyway, intellects a long time ago came up with the idea of randomicity, and we've never been able to demonstrate it as being real. But a great deal of theoretical development has centered on that, in particular quantum theory. Quantum theory is based, absolutely flat, straight out, based on the idea of something being random, which seems to fly in the face of what you would normally call a theory. You normally want a theory to be explicit, you know, in what it says about something, but quantum theory does not do
that. Right to where it is, just the scientists are admitting that it's not done.
Yeah, well, as far as I'm concerned, whenever you say random, to me that's nothing more than saying, that's nothing more than an admission of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
Which is exactly, unfortunately, what those people are that deny psychic experience occurs, because they're not accepting that there's something more than what they know, even though the proof is there.
That's right.
That's no other word for that except ignorance.
Somehow it violates their belief, and they think that because it violates their belief, it's violating their faith. And it's not. It's not. It might violate your belief, but it doesn't do any harm at all to your faith.
That's right.
Because I think St. Paul said that faith is the evidence of things not seen. But what he's saying is that faith is evidentiary. It's based on evidence. Right? And so when you see evidence, you accept it. You don't deny it.
It really supports your cause more. You just don't.
I mean, it's denial of faith if you deny evidence. Even the simplest form of faith is being denied if you do that. So we need to wake up a little more, you know, and be honest about these things, and because our progress...
It's going to change. The mass consciousness in the world we live in is going to change whether these people like it or not. You might as well face it.
That's always true, isn't it? You have the laggards, the ones that have to be pulled along. That's okay. That's fine. That's the way
it should be. You can't stop the storm coming.
Nah. No, I agree with that. And I think our next... You know, it's often been said that evolution is a herky-jerky kind of process. You don't get smooth evolution. And where we are now as a species is we have been for quite some time now in a on a level field where we're not rolling very effectively one way or the other. And when you hit a pinnacle or you hit a point where you suddenly start to move rapidly, that's one of those evolutionary instabilities.
Evolutionary jumps, yeah.
Yeah, evolutionary jumps where you suddenly now move to a different level, or relatively so.
Yeah, that, you can describe that in a way for people that, you know, I believe that, you know, when the species started changing, it doesn't gradually change to a different nose. All of a sudden, there's a baby born with a different nose.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It doesn't just gradually change. It just happens. Baby's got a different nose, and from then on, it happens for a while.
What Sheldrake said for a long time, and most of the biological people just violently disagree with Sheldrake. But all he's doing is following the evidence.
That's right.
He said, "Look, here it is, folks. You can force it through your mold if you want to, but you're going to get lice when you do that."
I mean, we can see it right now. If a black person and a white person, let's say it's something real distinct, like a white person and a Chinese,
mm-hmm.
You know, your next child that gets born through that coupling doesn't gradually change. It's pretty much born to look Chinese.
Right. Or
it just evolutionary changes right at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And whenever these things happen, as Sheldrake so famously pointed out, He said whenever the little bird in London learned to pluck the cap out of a milk bottle sitting on the front porch, it happened almost overnight.
Instantaneously. It looked
the,
at
the
it.
Birds
it
were doing it everywhere. And so he said the morphic field is there, and whenever once something is permitted to happen, then it's given permission to everybody for it to happen.
On a conscious level.
On
the birds started doing it at the same time everywhere.
If we suddenly found a symbol that somebody was able to demonstrate by using the symbol that they could do healing.
Right.
And do it powerfully, right, and definitively. The permission has been set for that to happen.
In other words, if one man picked up a cross and found out that it had a magic power of healing everything it came in contact with, then that would work for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it spreads almost instantaneously because it has become permissible.
Mm-hmm.
And so we as human beings are children in the sense that we really don't want to take responsibility for our individual power. We really don't think we're good enough to do that.
We are source, whether we like it or not.
Whether we like it or not, that's right.
Well, Roy, I think that'll make a good segment. I hope everybody enjoys our Sunday morning discussion.
Well, that's been stimulating. I always love it. Thanks.
Take care. See you next week.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.